This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Lebanon's government is stepping down. Many Lebanese say, good riddance.
Their negligence, their corruption, their mismanagement is literally killing us.
Last week's explosion in Beirut badly damaged a local hospital. Doctors there tell us about the moment it happened.
Some patients were ejected from their beds. We've had glass has fallen. Parts of labs have been destroyed.
Also today, China makes its biggest arrest yet under its new security law. A Hong Kong media mogul who doesn't hold back against Beijing.
When you say you're fighting a Cold War and want American support, that is a huge red line for China's Communist Party.
And Canada loses a piece of its ice shelf as big as Manhattan. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Lebanese government is stepping down. Prime Minister Hassan Diab made the announcement today, 6 days after an explosion at Beirut's port killed at least 160 and injured thousands. Diab said, "We take a step back to stand with the people, to undergo this battle of change with them." The announcement comes after days of protests. The streets of Beirut, demonstrators outraged with endemic corruption and government incompetence. Sami Atallah is the director of the Lebanese Center for Policy Studies in Beirut. I asked him what the prime minister's announcement means now for Lebanon.
Well, it means that we're going into the unknown. The fact that we have no government right now, we're going to see how quickly have the political parties cooked up an alternative. The fact that the prime minister, who was acting under the pressure of the street, called for early election, made key political parties very uneasy about this decision. Having said that, the prime minister and this government is responsible for what happened last week, but so is the political establishment and all the political parties that are now trying to hold them accountable versus holding themselves accountable for the mess that we are in. The corruption is actually so systemic that even those who are trying to hold them accountable are as corrupt, if not even more so.
Well, Sami, you're pointing to a perennial dilemma, it seems, in Lebanon. The last toppling of the government did not lead to a change. Map out, then, what needs to be different this time around.
We need to have a break from this political system that ends up appointing the same people who will actually collude together at the expense of citizens' welfare. And this explosion has actually precisely shown how it just got much worse for all of us, whereby before they would not only not give us the right and proper services and infrastructure, now they've literally killed us because of the incompetence, mismanagement, and corruption. So now we're at the key juncture here. Either are we going to continue this game and they stay in power, or we have a break and have a new government and new people who would actually at least have some serious legislative power so can plant the seeds for a better tomorrow.
Will that satisfy the protesters? And how will protesters actually trust that the break is real, given so many years of mistrust?
Well, if they actually decide to appoint some key prominent personalities and a team that will actually lead us out of the mess, and they stay so out of it, then I think the people will accept that, because then they'll see a ray of hope that change can come and we can rebuild the state. And the dilemma is, will these people actually accept this, because this will de facto undermine their power? So these political parties have to do the calculation. And that would be very much determined by the strength of the people and the civil society and the protesters to keep the pressure on these people so they can actually allow other groups to rule and get us out of the mess, because they don't even have an idea how to get us in the mess. All what they care about is how they protect their own political and economic interests.
Sami Atallah is director of the Lebanese Center for Policy Studies. He's in Beirut. Sami, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, with pleasure.
The injuries from the Beirut explosion last week were devastating. One doctor tweeted, "It was like the doors to hell had opened." The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with staff at several Beirut hospitals to hear their accounts.
Pamela Zainoun is a nurse at St. George's Hospital in Beirut. It was the closest hospital to the epicenter of the blast. The explosion was so strong, she says, it knocked her off her feet. She passed out on the floor.
So I woke up, I did not know where I was.
She'd been hurled outside of the neonatal unit where she works.
I tried to go back through the door I went through, but the door was closed shut.
Behind those closed doors were five babies, all of them in incubators for health issues. Two were saved by a nurse and a father. Zainoun picked up the remaining three.
So we started running down the stairs. There was no electricity, blood everywhere, people screaming. We did not know even where the exit was.
In the frenzy, Zainoun got separated from the others. Her heart was racing because she knew she had to get the babies to another hospital quickly. They had to be incubated to survive.
Suddenly, I find myself carrying these three babies. So I decided to go in the opposite direction and walk on the road till I reach another peripheral hospital, which is close by our hospital.
Zainoun walked for about 40 minutes, babies in arm.
I reached there. They did not let me in because their situation was even worse than ours.
Injured staff, damaged building, no incubators.
So I walked again. A doctor that works at our hospital saw me walking on the street. He held me by the shoulders. He told me, "We need to focus. Calm down. We need to focus. We need to get these babies to safety."
No cars could get by because of the debris. Surprisingly, Zainoun says, through all the commotion, the babies weren't even crying.
So I always checked their color. Are they blue or are they pink? They were not crying. They were just sleeping, you know?
Eventually, they made it to a hospital that was still functioning, but there was only one incubator.
So I fit three babies in one incubator just to keep them warm and safe.
Shortly after, she says, the newborns were reunited with their parents. What Zainoun did is just one example of what medical staff were up against that night. Doctors and nurses in the city treated casualties on a scale they'd never seen before. All that while they themselves were still in shock. This was the scene at the emergency room at the American University of Beirut Medical Center. People are running around. One doctor rushes to the entrance as he's pulling on his protective gown.
It's horrible, basically.
Dr. Saeed Taraf shared this video with me. He's an anesthesiologist resident at the hospital. He says he just left for the day, but rushed back when officials announced something called Code D.
Which stands for disaster and basically says every physician who's around the hospital should report to duty.
Taraf was assigned to the operating room. He says everyone was working at full speed.
There was a shortage of everything, including blood products, so patients were literally just bleeding to death.
The explosion sent shards of glass and debris flying in the air, so doctors treated lots of lacerations and lots of bleeding. Fred Ptesh is a neurosurgery resident at another hospital in Beirut. He says some of the injured were patients already in the hospital.
Some patients were ejected from their beds. We've had glass has fallen. Parts of labs have been destroyed.
Ptesh says the hospital became a main trauma center.
I mean, we operated on children as young as 3 to 4 years old, knowing that most likely they won't make it. But in these situations, you can't decide. The heart is beating. You have to do your job.
In all, four Beirut hospitals were so badly damaged, they had to be taken out of operation. And four staff died, says Dr. Firas Abiad, who runs Lebanon's largest public hospital. He says some medical staff had to treat the wounded in the streets and parking lots. I asked him if he'd ever seen anything like this.
During the Civil War, we've seen casualties and we've seen car bombs and blasts of different magnitudes. But what is different this time is the magnitude.
Abiyat says hospitals were already under pressure from the coronavirus. Lebanon is going through an economic crisis too. The country imports nearly all of its medical supplies, he says, and now the port is destroyed. He's worried how hospitals will manage. The disaster may also trigger a surge in coronavirus cases because it's hard to follow social distancing during an emergency.
The hospitals, all the hospitals are working at almost full capacity, and it would be very hard to see where we can get additional capacity should there is an increase in the number of COVID cases.
Still, despite the challenges, doctors and nurses say they're far from giving up. Syed Taraf of the Beirut Medical Center has hardly stopped working. The other day, he helped deliver 12 babies.
They give me hope, these newborns. I saw happy parents. I saw like a new hope.
A new hope, he says, that Lebanon could use more of. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Police in Hong Kong today made their biggest arrest under China's harsh new security law that targets dissent in Hong Kong. Media mogul Jimmy Lai, he's been a vocal critic of China's Communist Party. This morning, the 71-year-old was taken from his Hong Kong mansion in handcuffs and later led through his newspaper's newsroom. With reporters live streaming his ordeal, Jimmy Lai is charged with collusion with foreign forces. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins me now. So what did this media tycoon do to upset Beijing so much, Patrick?
Yeah, Marco, I mean, this guy doesn't just merely dislike the Chinese Communist Party. He abhors them. He's this very rich tycoon who does not ever seem to be afraid of going to prison or even having his media empire taken away. And now it looks like that is happening. You know, he does come out and say things like this, which is from an interview this year with Fox News.
You know, the value of the West, the value of America, we are actually fighting the same war. Your new Cold War, we are fighting part of it because we share the same values with you.
So when you say you're fighting a Cold War and want American support, that is a huge red line for China's Communist Party. And Jimmy Lai just says stuff like this all the time.
So if Jimmy Lai has been criticizing China's government in Beijing for years, why arrest him now?
You know, as we all can see, the U.S. and China are in what may be the beginnings of some sort of Cold War over trade, technology, who controls territory in Asia, so many things. And Hong Kong has really been this flashpoint. You see U.S. politicians like Nancy Pelosi and Ted Cruz cheering on these protesters. Well, in response to that, over the weekend, the U.S. put out sanctions against Hong Kong's top leader, who is Carrie Lam. And that has provoked them to go after Jimmy Lai, or at least that's what it looks like. You know, he's been this golden boy for certain U.S. politicians, and then suddenly he gets swept away in retaliation.
So police also arrested Agnes Chow, someone who conforms more with the activists we've seen in the streets for the past year in Hong Kong. Remind us who Agnes Chow is, Patrick, and what she represents to the central government in Beijing.
Yeah, everybody in Hong Kong knows who Agnes Chow is. She was a teenage protester in 2014 for what was called the Umbrella Revolution. And since then, she's now in her early 20s, she has become sort of this is a very young protest movement, Marco. So a 23-year-old can be an elder statesman in this movement. And in a sense, that's what she has been. I just think it really sends a strong signal that no one is untouchable. So if you have Agnes Chow being taken down, Jimmy Lai being taken down, the Chinese Communist Party knows it's going to create a huge fuss. They know that the American media is going to make a big deal out of this, and they know that it can heighten tensions in this, you know, call it what you want, Cold War.
We also saw today that China has sanctioned 11 Americans, including lawmakers Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. What's the thinking behind that?
The sanctions have gone after senators that are very active in cheering on the Hong Kong protesters, but they've also gone after the head of Human Rights Watch, anyone that the Chinese Communist Party views as an American agitator towards the Hong Kong protests. And so what you're seeing is more tit-for-tat sanctioning. So the U.S. sanctions Hong Kong's political leader. They sanction Ted Cruz and some other senators, and it keeps escalating and escalating with no end in sight.
The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Friday on the show, we told you about the national election in Belarus. That vote happened yesterday. Last night in Minsk, the capital of Belarus, violent protests. Flashbang grenades, tear gas, water cannons, SWAT teams beating and arresting protesters. This after five-term incumbent president Alexander Lukashenko won in a landslide, according to official exit polls there. The results are highly disputed. The opposition believes their candidate won, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. So Belarus is into its second day of mass protests and clashes in the streets. Reporter Charles Maines has been closely following what's going on and joins us from Moscow. Bring us up to speed, Charles. What happened yesterday after the election results in Belarus came in?
Well, right. So this election was supposed to be the most challenging of Lukashenko's 26-year career, or it appeared to be that way until the results started coming in. 80% of the vote, a landslide, with just 10% going to Tikhanovskaya, which, as you mentioned, was the main competitor here. Her voters found these results absolutely laughable, but in a way they were predictable too. You know, Lukashenko controls the electoral apparatus in Belarus, and we also saw big demonstrations against Lukashenko last night in Minsk and other cities. Protesters facing off against these heavily armed security forces. There were 3,000 arrests, dozens of injuries, reports of one death. So all in all, just a tense night in Belarus.
So protesters are saying the election was rigged. That's the view from the camp of Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. What are they pointing to as evidence?
Well, a lot of things. First, there was over 40% early voting. That's a suspiciously high number that suggests state employees were forced to vote for Lukashenko in advance of the final day. We had evidence of ballot stuffing. And if that wasn't enough, Tikhanovskaya's coalition used a code. They were folding ballots in a certain way horizontally that made it easier to identify them once they were thrown in the bin. And a lot of the bins certainly looked like they were heavily in her favor. Now, finally, you can point to polls that closed on would-be voters in a lot of cities across the world, and including Moscow. These were many voters who stood in long, long lines. I can say in Moscow we had lines around the block with many unable to vote. In fact, they broke out into chants of "Let us vote" and for Lukashenko to leave power when doors closed at 8 p.m. and many were turned away.
So you spoke with some of those Belarusian voters in Moscow. What were they telling you?
Well, the main message was that they've had enough. You know, they want change. And let me bring in a voice here. This is Alexandra Shaparova. She's a film director from Belarus who's studying now in Moscow. So here she says that she's 26. That's the same number of years that Lukashenko has been in power. And she jokes that she's part of this new generation of Belarusians who've grown old with him. And she wants change.
What has the opposition candidate, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, actually said?
Well, Tikhanovskaya said today that she doesn't accept the result, but she did also add that she felt that their side had won in moral terms.
Мы победили свой страх. Мы победили свою аполитичность.
So here she's saying we won over our fears, our apathy, and this was the most important victory of all.
President Lukashenko has faced challenges before. What makes this time different?
What's different this time is COVID. Lukashenko really mocked the pandemic as a mass psychosis. He said, you know, you could cure it with a shot of vodka and didn't take it very seriously. And what happened was it left to civil society to fill in the absence of the state and kind of take care of business. And this approach that we can do it ourselves is kind of transferred now into politics. When you talk to people, is that while Lukashenko may hold the title of president, at least officially for now, you know, for a lot of people, this rigged vote, this violence against protesters, and this botched COVID response, you know, that really has cost him any right to claim he's the national leader.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow with the news about yesterday's elections in Belarus. Thanks very much, Charles. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Marco.
The largest ice shelf in Canada's Arctic has broken apart. A giant slab of ice the size of Manhattan is now drifting in Arctic waters. Scientists say climate change is partly to blame. Joining me is University of Ottawa's Luke Copland. He's an expert on the frozen parts of our world. It is hard to sometimes get a sense of the gravity and meaning of some headlines about the environment. Hottest month on record, hottest year on record, permafrost melting in Siberia, sea rise increasing. How big a piece of news is this about this ice shelf in Canada, Luke?
Yeah, it's pretty major. I mean, until the summer, this was the largest remaining intact ice shelf that we had in the Northern Hemisphere, really.
So help us understand what an ice shelf actually is and what are the impacts of this event?
Yeah, so an ice shelf is a piece of ice which is permanently preserved on the ocean surface. For the moon ice shelf, it's been there for at least 4,000 years. So you can think of them a little bit like glaciers. They're like glaciers that are floating on the ocean, but they're permanent features. For the moon ice shelf, it's about 300 feet thick at its thickest.
How normal is it for such large pieces to break off?
It's really rare, although unfortunately kind of becoming more common, that these ice shelves, they've taken many hundreds of years to form. And these breakups, though, we've started to see them occur more frequently in the recent past. If we look at the last 20 years, there was about 1,000 square kilometers worth of ice shelf in the year 2000. Compared to today, there's less than half of that left.
What did you think when you first heard the news about the Milne ice shelf and such a large break had happened? What was your reaction?
Well, kind of two things. I mean, I was both really surprised. Of course, it is such a huge, sudden thing to happen all at once. At the same time, perhaps not entirely surprised, because we've been working on this ice shelf for the last 10 years or so. And from those measurements, it's clear that the ice shelf has been thinning through time. It's been responding to warmer temperatures on its surface. It's been responding to warmer ocean temperatures underneath it. Although it's really surprising to see it on the day, the fact that it occurred wasn't a big surprise, because it fits in with this long-term warming that we've seen in this area.
Right. So we've been covering the heat wave in Siberia. Is the breaking of the Milne ice shelf related to this record-breaking heat in the far north around the Arctic that we've been seeing this summer? And what's the connection?
When we look at changes to the Canadian Arctic since the 1960s, we've seen warming rates at about 2 to 3 times more than what they are happening down south. We've had that long-term background of warming and weakening, thinning of the ice shelf. Then in the years when we lose ice shelves, those are years when we have these super warm temperatures. And this year is one of those years. We've had temperatures for the entire summer about 5 degrees Celsius warmer than the long-term average. Throughout the entire Arctic, this year has been really, really warm in comparison to anything we've seen in the past.
So are there events, Luke, that this could lead to? Like if the Milne ice shelf breaks, then what?
You think of ice shelves as a bit of like a canary in the coal mine, in a sense that they're kind of early indicators of the impacts of climate change and how the climate is changing across different parts around the world. These ice shelf losses tell us that we're seeing these big changes in the Arctic. But when we look into the future, those kinds of warm temperatures, warming rates that we're seeing in the Arctic, we expect to see spread further south, close to where we're living, for the cities around us.
The Milne ice shelf is 4,000 years old. It's almost half gone now. Are we losing something that we'll likely never get back? I mean, is it gone forever, or can ice shelves build back under ideal conditions?
Yeah, it's really tough for ice shelves to build back. I mean, to lose them, the piece breaks off in an hour or two. It's very, very quick to lose an ice shelf. But to rebuild an ice shelf is really a difficult process. For that to happen, you need to have really cold temperatures, and we don't have those cold temperatures right now. Even if the temperatures were cold enough for ice shelves to form, it would take a long, long time, decades to centuries, for them to form. But in today's climate, we don't have that.
Luke Copland, a glaciologist at the University of Ottawa, thank you for talking to us about this. Not very happy news, but thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The World. What's the next big national security threat? A bomb, an asteroid, or another pandemic? Whatever it'll be, planning for it needs an update.
We have this roadmap kind of the Cold War. It doesn't exactly work, but we don't know what else to follow.
Threats, known and unknown, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. It's not as if we didn't know. Public health experts had been warning us for years, a pandemic is a real possibility. We should be prepared for it. Yet we were unprepared for COVID-19. And here we are in the U.S. with another depressing marker in the pandemic, 5 million reported coronavirus infections. We tend to think about threats as things that are big, noisy, obvious. It's easier to see them coming. Our friends at the National Security Podcast, Things That Go Boom, often focus on those big threats, things like weapons and bombs. But this season, they're asking, what else are we missing? So this week here on The World, we're featuring the reporting from Things That Go Boom, looking at global threats that are slipping under the radar, like this pandemic and other things. Lacey Healy from Things That Go Boom takes it from here.
Staying safe is about preparing for the threats that face us, the ones that we're expecting and the ones that catch us off guard. For an idea of what it means to be truly prepared, we talked to Alden Wicker.
I'm extremely organized and I like to have everything laid out in front of me, especially when it's something sort of big and massive.
Normally, Alden would have been at a recording studio or radio station, but it's the time of Corona. So she was in her living room and I was interviewing her from my recording studio.
I love your closet. Looks so organized.
Otherwise known as my closet.
This is like a little bit of like...
Looks like jersey cotton.
Like a jersey cotton with a little bit of stretch.
Alden knows a lot about clothes.
I am a sustainable fashion journalist and expert, and I live in Brooklyn.
Here's what else you need to know about Alden. She's an expert planner, and this story might seem a little quirky. Just stay with me. She has a spreadsheet for everything. Even cities she and her husband want to visit. That one includes columns for the number of days they want to spend in each place, the country code, the cost of living there. You get the picture. Then coronavirus came. Scary, yes, but no match for Alden. She was early to the game. And there wasn't a lot of stockpiling advice out there. So she sent out a tweet, a call for help.
I was like, where are all the fancy recipe blogs with their like non-perishable recipes for people who eat kale?
That didn't work, but she did find this one website.
This website that was like beautifully organized, very ugly, but beautifully organized.
Ugly as in bare bones. There was a pixelated American flag in one corner.
And then down below, there's this really old style GIF of like a letter going into a mail slot, you know, like email me.
So that was a little off. But there was something about this website that Alden found appealing.
It had this like beautiful spreadsheet with like how many cans of this proteins you need and how many cans of vegetables and like what sauces you need. And then it had recipes. A lot of these recipes are like, take one can of this kind of soup, take another can of this kind of soup, put it together.
Can you tell me about some of the recipes actually? So like, are there some in particular that you remember?
So there's one dessert called the double-decker salty Nutella sandwich.
Oh.
And it involves saltine crackers, a can of cherries and syrup, almonds, and a jar of Nutella. And I would probably eat this on a normal day if I was feeling emotional. So I was like, great, that's going on the list.
So Alden and her husband pulled out the big bin they used to pack up stuff for Burning Man, the Burning Man bin, and started stockpiling. And in the middle of all this, something happened.
So there was a moment where I was reading all the recipes to my husband and saying, like, stop me if any of these sound disgusting. And so I was reading them off and there was something like Millennium Chowder and then there was like Millennium something else. And he was like, why is everything called Millennium? And I was like, I don't know. And then I looked at the top of the website and it's a Y2K prepper website.
Y2K, as in the year 2000 computer glitch that was going to shut down power grids and wipe out all our bank accounts. It was also called the Millennium Bug, but actually it ended up being a Millennium Fizzle.
So it's like everything is 20 years old.
Oh my gosh.
So she was prepared, but she was prepared for the wrong apocalypse. A lot of defense experts would tell you that Alden's Burning Man bin, bursting with 20-year-old recipes and food she'll never eat, isn't a bad analogy for the way we plan our national security strategy. We spend over $700 billion on defense every year. That's about a sixth of our overall budget, more than healthcare, education, and all of the rest of our discretionary spending combined. A lot of that money goes to things like maintaining our nuclear weapons, buying aircraft carriers and fighter jets, and, you know, fighting wars, big and small. But we pay our defense contractors like rock stars. Sometimes we buy $10,000 toilet covers and $85 million instruction manuals. And for a while now, the sky has sort of been the limit on what we're willing to spend on defense. And part of the reason we spend so much money has to do with some really old ideas on what war even is. It seems like an eternity now, but a few months ago, when we could all still gather in large groups, I went to a national security conference for folks who work in and around the defense industry, an event associated with the publication of the same name called Defense One 2020. And while I was there, I noticed the words great power competition like a rash all over the panel descriptions. That's this phrase that's been floating around Washington to the point where it's almost become a cliche. So I asked folks what it means. But the answers were a little mushy.
What do we mean when we say great power competition?
I think the entire community, the national security and defense community, is very much struggling with that.
But I think we should probably really look at it through the lens of competition.
And recognizing that those people with which we have some level of adversarial relationship, we need to deal with.
Cyberspace, of space, et cetera, et cetera.
To something bigger.
Which is to say, have more, bigger, faster than any other country in the world.
It's a good thing you guys edit this.
DIME, right? The diplomatic, information, military, economic.
Something along those lines.
Basically, for most of the last century, the U.S. lived in a world where big, great power rivalries took center stage. World War I, World War II, the Cold War. It was us against them. And them mostly meant other big countries. Then 9/11 happened.
And night fell on a different world.
And the war on terror began.
A world where freedom
and terrorism didn't have a home.
Under attack.
It was everywhere.
There are thousands of these terrorists in more than 60 countries.
And suddenly we thought, maybe this is what we do now.
We will rally the world to this cause by our efforts, by our courage. We will not falter, and we will not fail.
And maybe world wars are a thing of the past.
I'm Lacey Healy, and you're listening to Things That Go Boom, a special feature this week on The World. We're looking at big shifts in our thinking about national security and how the pandemic fits into that picture. 9/11, obviously, led to a huge shift in how we think about global threats. Then there was another shift.
Well, good morning, and thank you all for taking time to...
In 2018, in unveiling a new national defense strategy, the Secretary of Defense at the time, General Jim Mattis, cemented the words that had just begun to show up in strategy documents the year before.
We will continue to prosecute the campaign against terrorists that we're engaged in today, but great power competition, not terrorism, is now the primary focus of U.S. national security.
The whole thing didn't exactly come out of the blue.
The world, to quote George Shultz, is awash in change.
China had been building military outposts on contested coral reefs in the South China Sea, and Vladimir Putin had illegally annexed Crimea.
With great power competition between nations becoming a reality once again.
General Mattis and many others drew a logical conclusion. Great power competition was the new black. But a lot of defense folks are still very divided on what exactly this competition thing even means. Is it economic, technological? Is it military? Are we headed to another world war? I asked Kathleen Hicks, who directs the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in D.C., to help me understand the current state of affairs. And she described our current national security roadmap like this.
Here's the best one I can come up with. It's the episode of The Office where Michael and Dwight follow the GPS system in the car.
No, look. It means go up to the right, bear right, over the bridge, and hook up with 307.
Make a right
Maybe it's
turn.
A shortcut, Dwight. It said go to the right.
It can't mean that. There's a lake there.
I think it knows where it is going.
And go into a lake. And I think this is sort of where we are. We have this roadmap kind of the Cold War. It doesn't exactly work, but we don't know what else to follow. And we don't really know where it's going. There isn't a plan, but it seems like it's right. And it's following some kind of vague sentiment about what's been wrong in the past. And where do we end up? You know, we end up with the car in a lake.
Hicks says she doesn't really like the term great power competition.
It's a throwback, if you will, term to an era in which you had a number of states that are of roughly equal power stature who are competing for power and influence.
But she's clear on who our two main rivals are.
Today's great power competition focus is primarily on China and secondarily on Russia, two countries that have very different profiles. Russia is a declining power, but that doesn't necessarily make it less dangerous. In fact, it may make it more dangerous because there's incentive to gamble for significant payoff early and quickly. And so the Russians are the most opportunistic in terms of disinformation, obviously coming after the U.S. election process.
Should we be thinking of China as a threat?
Yeah, I think we should be thinking about China as a threat, but the difference is we shouldn't be thinking of China only as a threat. The Chinese are not on a inevitable rise to be the superpower of the future, and the United States is not on an inevitable decline.
To be fair, our adversaries have been building a whole lot of big weapons. China only spends about a third of what the U.S. does in its military. But that spending also rose by 83% between 2009 and 2018. So it's bulking up. And Russia, well, it spends a whole lot less. But as we learned during the 2016 election, Russia can be creative with what it has. So I asked the folks at the Defense One conference what they saw as the biggest threat that we face. Was it hypersonic missiles? An incident in the South China Sea? And what is the greatest national security threat that we face today?
Climate change.
Climate change.
Yes.
Divisiveness within the United States, and I think that is the biggest threat to us and our democracy.
They did not say hypersonic missiles. In fact, some were a little worried that we might be putting too much time and money into military solutions.
We started to let, you know, economic and political levers, even like the information lever of power, kind of atrophy. You know, the military is an easy button in some senses. So I think that we've got to kind of walk that back, which I feel like a heretic for saying that.
The military instrument power in great power competition should be both very small and in support of the others, rather what it's doing right now, which is kind of leading the way.
This kind of talk isn't completely unheard of. In fact, General Mattis also famously said that, quote, if you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition. But coming from defense folks, it was still a surprise. Hicks was sure to note that we can't discount the value of a strong military. That's not what this is about.
I mean, I would hate for anyone to come away with the thought that we've got that covered and all we have to worry about are these other elements of power. We are in a walk and chew gum situation.
But she agrees that right now, we're chewing a lot more than we're walking.
The balance has tilted so far away from having civilian capacity and capability that it's really becoming quite apparent that we increasingly rely on our military in part because it's the only thing that we've kept relatively healthy and funded. And if we just keep doing that and keep allowing those civilian capacities to atrophy, we're not going to have the kind of toolkit we need to deal with the challenges of the future.
And just think about these statements now. According to some calculations, we could buy 2,200 ventilators for the price of one F-35. And just 1 year of spending on nuclear weapons could provide 300,000 ICU beds, 35,000 ventilators, and 75,000 doctor salaries. In 2019, before any of us had even heard of COVID-19, Hicks took part in a simulation, like a virtual war game.
Sometimes you have things like a fake news real run, or you'll have a board, literally like a Risk game board, or even a computerized version of that that sets a scene. In this case, what we had was a paper. Would it be helpful if I read a little bit of the setup?
Sure. That would be great.
So the way we opened up was to say, the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency of international concern on January 4, 2025, as infection rates of a SARS, MERS-like coronavirus
sound familiar?
Reached 800 million globally, killing 25 million.
So Hicks wasn't exactly surprised when the coronavirus upended our lives.
Few countries have been left unaffected by the outbreak, and the global economy has dipped into recession.
She'd been through it once before. Well, kind of. What did surprise her was how totally ineffectual governments were. The lack of clear communication, the lack of international cooperation, the lack of medical equipment.
And the way we plan for crises is often around a clear culminating point, an invasion across you know, a border or an explosion occurs. In reality, what we see is the international environment doesn't give us that crystal clear point. We always worry about bolt out of the blue. But when you're denied that culminating point, and this pandemic is a perfect example of this, and instead when it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds.
March 5th.
I break down crying just before bed.
March 15th.
We all need haircuts already.
Schools are closed.
March 16th.
Toilet paper is gone.
I tell Mark I'm so scared.
We stay home.
In many ways, that's harder for us. And by the time it's at a crisis point, it's been underway for months.
And that takes us straight back to the central question we're asking this week. What other kinds of security risks are building out there? For The World and Things That Go Boom, I'm Lacey Healy.
Things That Go Boom is a podcast about national security from PRX and Inkstick Media. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Today's story was produced by Ruth Morris. This week, we're featuring Lacey and her team's reporting on global threats that take on a slightly different shape than traditional warfare. We'll follow China's rise as a global economic power, look at how xenophobia can undermine national security, and focus on mercenary armies and how they're changing the way we fight.
And this rising tide of mercenaries, eventually in a decade or two, will get to a point where war is privatized, where anybody who can swipe a big enough check can become a superpower.
That's tomorrow here on The World. With 3 million cases, Brazil has the second most coronavirus infections and deaths from the disease. The U.S., as you've heard, is sadly number one. In Brazil, COVID-19 has killed over 100,000 people. Brazil's poor and unemployed have been among the hardest hit, and not just by the illness. More than 2,000 families have been evicted from their homes during the pandemic, a number that continues to rise. Michael Fox has our story from southern Brazil.
In the city of Sao Paulo, members of the homeless workers movement are leading a march to the state governor's palace. They're demanding an end to forced evictions. They chant, "I am homeless. I am from the streets." Jussara Basso is the Sao Paulo coordinator of the movement. In a video posted on Twitter, Basso says, "We are marching to denounce the evictions that the governor has been pushing." While he appears in the press telling people to stay home, not one housing policy has been created, and not one home has been built. Despite the pandemic and rising unemployment, the number of forced evictions in Brazil has roughly doubled in recent months. Brazil is one of the most unequal countries in the world. Even before the pandemic, poverty was on the rise for several years. There is a national housing deficit of almost 8 million homes. That means millions of families cannot afford basic rent, and they're forced to live in precarious housing in favelas or slums, often without sanitation or even running water. And their numbers are increasing during the pandemic.
Essa aqui é a minha casa. Meu banheiro fica pro lado de fora.
Erika Cavalcanti da Silva is one of them. She's 36, black, and she lives with her husband and 4 kids in a 9x12 wooden shack they've built themselves over the last year. It's in a community called Faith in God, on the outskirts of the city of Ribeirão Preto in Sao Paulo. This is from a video Erika sent me, shot in mid-April. She's watching as backhoes rip down 20 of her neighbor's homes. Authorities ordered the demolition. She says that with the help of local organizers, they were able to stop it. Since then, the neighborhood has grown, but the police are constantly threatening to return. In the meantime, because of the COVID-19 crisis, Erika says she lost most of her housekeeping work. Her husband, who has lung problems, had to quit his job driving Uber. The monthly government support they've been receiving amid the pandemic runs out this month. She says she doesn't know what they'll do. I am scared, Erika tells me in a phone interview. I'm scared to death that my daughter, who's pregnant, will catch coronavirus. City officials, she says, think that only criminals live in the favela, but we are families here. The evictions taking place in neighborhoods like Erika's are often violent. In this YouTube video of a forced removal in another part of Sao Paulo, police are firing rubber bullets toward a cluster of makeshift homes as a man rushes an elderly woman out of the way.
Eu vou ter que parar um pouco a transmissão porque tá um pouco difícil de falar. Tem bastante fumaça.
That's reporter Maria Teresa Cruz in a different video. She's describing the scene from a nearby roof, but she has to stop her report as clouds of tear gas waft over the area and into nearby neighborhoods. This sort of thing seems to be happening daily around the country. But activists are fighting back.
Temos que dizer que é despejo zero para poder dizer que o despejo é uma...
Late last month, a coalition of more than 50 Brazilian social groups launched a campaign to end the evictions. They're demanding judicial and legislative action. Housing and human rights lawyer Dito Barbosa is one of the lead organizers.
Ser despejado nesse momento é uma questão de vida ou morte. Ter a moradia, algum tipo
says,
de proteção...
To be evicted at this moment is a question of life or death. To have a home is a question of life or death. It's not just the federal government. The mayors and local governments should be protecting people. The United Nations has also weighed in, twice calling on Brazilian authorities to suspend forced removals during coronavirus. Alan Grimard is a senior officer at the UN.
It's part of human rights. The decent housing, access to decent housing, is has always been part of human rights. So evicting people that will ending in not having access to adequate housing is a violation of human rights.
That sounds straightforward enough. But here in Brazil, those recommendations are being largely ignored.
O vírus. 70% vai ser contaminado. Não adianta, se não for hoje, vai semana que vem.
President Jair Bolsonaro has repeatedly downplayed the virus and insisted on the need to reopen the economy. In June, he vetoed a bill that would have suspended evictions of families unable to pay rent during the pandemic. Brazil's economy is expected to tank by more than 8% this year. Unemployment is at 13% and climbing. There is movement on legislation in Congress to suspend evictions, but even if passed, it would likely still face a veto from Bolsonaro. Meanwhile, the numbers in this COVID-19 crisis continue to go up, along with the number of evictions, with no clear path ahead. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
The coronavirus crisis is global in reach. Communities that were fragile before the pandemic, like war zones and refugee settlements, they've obviously not been spared. As part of our regular series of online conversations on the pandemic, The World's Ilana Gordon will moderate a discussion tomorrow with Jocelyn Kelly from the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. They also want to answer your questions, so send an email to myworld@theworld.org and join the conversation live on our website at 12 noon Eastern. Tomorrow, we're at theworld.org. Even during the pandemic, artists in Mali are still making music. We leave you today with new music from Mali that's getting critical acclaim far afield. This is Bamba Wasulu Groove with a track called Dankele. We come to you from the Nana Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you back here tomorrow.